This week on Making Contact.
What do you do then instead of keeping your mouth shut? What else is there to do? Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence.
Whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg secured his place in U.S. history in 1971 when he leaked 7,000 pages of classified top secret documents to the New York Times. Those documents are known as the Pentagon Papers, a Pentagon Commission report of the U.S.'s 30-year involvement in Indochina that led to the Vietnam War. And they revealed a massive government cover-up. On this edition, we hear from Ellsberg delivering a speech to anti-war activists in Crawford, Texas. He reflects on civil disobedience, advocating for people to blow the whistle and go to jail in order to save lives. I'm Tina Rubio, your host on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
The thing, though, that Henry, that to me is just unconscionable, this is treasonable action on the part of the bastards that put it out. Doesn't it involve secure information, a lot of other things? What kind of people would do such things?
That's Richard Nixon in a conversation with Henry Kissinger, June 13, 1971, the day the New York Times published the first in its Pentagon Papers series. The Nixon administration tried to block publication of the series, but the U.S. Supreme Court rejected it. To this day, it remains a milestone in national security classification policy and a victory for freedom of the press. So who is Daniel Ellsberg? Ellsberg was born in 1931 in Detroit, Michigan. In the 1950s, he served in the U.S. Marine Corps as a rifle platoon leader, operations officer, and rifle company commander. In 1962, he graduated from Harvard with a Ph.D. in economics and later was a consultant to the Department of Defense and the White House. It was clear. Ellsberg was proud to fight the U.S. fight against communism. But upon his return from Vietnam, his mindset slowly started to shift.
I had opposed the war since 67 when I came back after 2 years in Vietnam. I knew, like nearly everybody there, that it was unwinnable, that what we were doing would make no progress, had made no progress, we were thoroughly stalemated, it could go on indefinitely, and we should be out of there. But everybody thought that who'd been in Vietnam, but the question was what to do about it. And for 2 years, I continued to work as an insider. I talked to candidates, all the candidates nearly, in 68. I worked for Bobby Kennedy, probably helped give policy line for some of his speeches. I wrote memos, I did this and that. And of course, none of that was making any difference.
It was in 1969 when Ellsberg, just months after leaving Vietnam, went to work for the RAND Corporation, a think tank known for setting national standards on foreign and domestic policy. There he worked on a study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, what's better known today as the Pentagon Papers. Because of that work, Ellsberg knew firsthand that the war was going nowhere, that U.S. leaders didn't expect it to, and that the number of casualties were sure to rise.
In the summer of 69, I learned several things. I knew the war was going to get bigger. I went to a meeting of the War Resisters League because I'd been reading Thoreau and I'd been reading Martin Luther King. And King's statement, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it." So I wanted to meet people who were living by that philosophy, which King got directly from Thoreau and Gandhi, Gandhi in particular, and he'd read those texts. And now he was confronted with Rosa Parks, who was living them, who was acting on them.
When Ellsberg photocopied 7,000 pages, 47 volumes, of classified documents, he was wrangling with these very concepts: civil disobedience, patriotism, truth, and justice. And when he was charged with 12 felonies and faced 115 years in prison, he drew his inspiration from those same people, Henry David Thoreau, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Rosa Parks.
I had the wonderful honor and privilege of meeting Rosa Parks on my way to arraignment in 1971. I was invited on my way to arraignment in Los Angeles from Boston to speak to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that night. I go right from the airport. I didn't even pack a bag. I just had my wife send the bag on to Los Angeles, took a toothbrush and a razor, and I ran to a plane. I got on there just in time to say to this audience on a very hot night, if it were not for your leader, Martin Luther King, and Rosa Parks, I would not be where I am today, on my way to arraignment in Los Angeles for having found a way to oppose this war. So, fine. Then there was Rosa Parks on the platform right with me. So I had the chance to tell her she was my hero and to ask her. I talked to her a little bit. And I'll tell you something I've never seen in a book, something she told me. I said, is it true what they say about you that you just happened to be tired that day, very tired? She said, no, I wasn't any more tired than usual. I was always tired, you know. It's an ordinary day. So I said, well, why that day? Now, something I didn't know about her till later, she'd been sort of readying herself for that day for quite a while. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. So she was not just your, you know, unpolitical seamstress. All the more reason to ask, why then that day? So I said, you must have confronted the same situation many times. Why that particular day? Did you say, no, I won't get up? She said, no, I had given my seat up a number of times to a white woman. And I'd never had a man ask for my seat before. And she said, I'd often ask myself, what would I do or what will I do if a man tells me I have to give up my seat and go to the back of the bus? She said. So I said, well, what did you answer? What did you think? She said, I didn't know. I didn't know what I would do. So finally the situation arose. And she didn't. She said no. And that's what, and of course, her example is what told Martin Luther King, as he said, it was confronting him. He didn't want to make waves. He had just come to this town where his father was a very well-known preacher and a conservative one, later a Republican. He wasn't there to revolutionize. Either he joined Rosa Parks or he didn't. And so the movement went from there.
And in a way, that's what Ellsberg himself faced in 1969, when he later questioned Rosa Parks, why then, why that day? He must have seen something of his own situation staring back at him. And in the end, that's what it came down to. Fully support the anti-war movement and get involved, or don't.
My experience was then that I was at a meeting at the War Resisters League in Haverford, Pennsylvania, in 1969, and I was asking myself, you know, I knew the war was going to get bigger, what to do about it. And I met a young man named Randy Keeler, who seemed very, very intelligent and eloquent, and I really liked him, a young man, and he had a background like mine. He'd been to Harvard, he'd come out to Stanford to go to education school, and then he got caught up in the anti-war movement. He got arrested, he went to Santa Rita. I was hearing him speak. And it was an international conference, so there were people from all over the world, pacifists mainly and war resistors. And I was thinking as he was speaking, I'm glad they can see this man, because he's the best we've got. He's our best. And I want them to see him as an American. He was talking about his past and how he got into the anti-war movement. And then he mentioned that as the head of the anti-war office, the War Resisters League, in San Francisco, he said he was the last man left in the group, because all the others were now in prison. And he said, and I'm happy to say that I will soon be joining them. And nobody saw this coming. Nobody knew that he had already been convicted and was scheduled to go to prison for 2 years for draft non-coordination, non-cooperation with the draft. So it was just a surprise. And here I was thinking, this is our best young American, you know, and so going to prison? And he continued, and then went on. And when he ended, a friend of mine was going to speak, but I couldn't speak anymore. I couldn't listen anymore. And I went to the back of the auditorium, and I was crying. And really, half the audience was crying at this point. They're all cheering and crying. And I was just crying sort of ordinarily. And then I went to a men's room, found a little room in the end. It was all empty. And I went inside there, and I just sat down on the floor, and I started sobbing. Hysterically, really. I'd only done that once or twice, maybe once before, actually when Bobby Kennedy died. And just hysterical. And I sat there for a long time. Nobody came in. And I was thinking, we are eating our young. That was the phrase in my mind. We are eating our young. And I was crying and I was thinking, this is what my country has come to, where the best thing a young American can do is go to prison. And then there was a line by a song from a song by Leonard Cohen. So it's come to this, it's come to this. And wasn't it a long way down? And wasn't it a strange way down?
And everywhere you wandered, love seemed to go along with you. That's a hard one to remember, yes, it makes you clench your fist, and then the veins stand out like highways all along your wrist. And yes, it's come to this, it's come to this.
That was in my mind. And I was thinking my son, who was then 69, he was then 14. And I thought, my son is born for jail. So anyway, I cried. I got up and I washed my face. And then I sat down. Then I cried some more. And then I got up and washed my face some more. And finally, at the end of it, I thought, okay, what can I do to help end the war now that I'm ready to go to jail? Because I knew if he could do it, if that was the right thing for him to do, then it could be the right thing for me to do. And I began asking, it wasn't necessarily that didn't tell me exactly what to do, or even that I had to go to prison, but it did mean cast your whole vote. I'd finally figured out what that meant. And it meant risk your career, risk being called names, risk your family.
We'll have more from Daniel Ellsberg in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact. Ellsberg did risk it all. When he surrendered to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston in June of 1971, he expected to spend the rest of his life in prison. When the federal charges were dismissed 2 years later on the grounds of government misconduct against him, Ellsberg, who never spent significant time in jail for the leaked report, prepared to live his life answering his own question, "What can I do to help end the war now that I'm ready to go to prison?"
What do you do then instead of keeping your mouth shut? What else is there to do? So he says, Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. He says there are thousands, and this is now so current, there are thousands who are in opinion, he underlines that, opposed to slavery and to the war, and who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them. They say they know not what to do and do nothing. They hesitate and they regret, and sometimes they petition. But they do nothing in earnest and with effect. They will wait, well disposed, for others to remedy the evil, that they may no longer have it to regret. Does that by any chance sound like any Democrats in Congress? What will they do? Will they use their power in Congress, in other words, to obstruct, to demand, to indict, to impeach, to prosecute, to get these people out? We'll see. Don't leave it to them, though. Don't hold your breath. So what he says then, cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. Thoreau is asking here, he says, in 1775, people thought everybody recognizes the right of revolution. He says people thought that it was necessary to revolutionize in 1775. But he says now, slavery, aggression, is the time to resist. And how? And he doesn't talk about violence in here. But and of course, what he invented, in a way, was civil disobedience, just disobeying an unjust law. If there is another 9/11 in this country, which I expect, I think this administration will use it as a Reichstag fire was used in February 27th, 1933, by a chancellor who had been elected to office, but only with 34% of the vote, offered to join. He had a plurality and was urged to be chancellor. He raised that after he banned the Communist Party, one of the largest parties, banned it, imprisoned its leaders, put them in prison just before the election, stopped the Social Democrats, a larger party, from campaigning at the last part of the election, the last election, March 5th. And he still only managed to raise that vote from 34% to 44%. 56% of the German people voted against Hitler. That was on March 5th. Goering said later, the number two man in the party, said later, I set fire to the Reichstag, but they blamed it on the communists. And on the next day, a week before the election, they rescinded freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of petition, and privacy of the postal service, among other things. And within months, they had a one-party state there, and that was the end of elections. And the question was, what had Germans done about it to resist it? That's what we're facing right now. But the reason for showing that we're ready to cast our whole vote is because this may be one of our last chances to vote at all. It'll be that much harder. Civil disobedience will look a lot different after the next 9/11, with detention camps, as in Germany in 1933, or in America in 1942 with the Japanese. I think there will be more Middle Easterners, maybe in a camp, after the next 9/11. And how many Americans will oppose that? We will. And we may be in those camps too.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
Before using any military might of his choosing, W just accuses them of starting the fight, or says they might. And Congress gets in a fright and votes W the right to kill who he will, without showing any evidence or even making sense. Here's the situation. W's administration puts people into jail with no possibility of bail. In W's New Deal, the right to appeal or even hear the crime of which you're accused and serving time for can be excused, and your rights of privacy can disappear. And if you don't like it, well, you can stick it in your ear. Now we'll see if you and me will go along, stamp our feet and repeat the military song, like the Germans did in 33. Like the Germans did in 33.
We'll have more from Daniel Ellsberg in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Daniel Ellsberg became an iconic figure in the U.S. anti-war movement, not just throwing away a comfortable life of diplomacy and government favor, but really defying the Nixon administration, challenging accepted authority, and, from the belly of the beast, challenging the U.S. government, its authority, its legitimacy. So it's no surprise to find Ellsberg sharing his own inspirations with a crowd of activists just miles from President Bush's Crawford Ranch, Thanksgiving Day, 2005. Surrounded by memories of soldiers killed in the current Iraq War, Ellsberg reflected on what inspired him in 1971 and what still inspires him today.
Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, I'd read this many times, but most recently I started reading it again when, on the day of March 19th, 2003, it was the beginning of shock and awe, and I had already agreed to be part of an action by Code Pink in front of the White House on a street, obstructing a street. So all the Code Pink people were lying down in the street, and I took sort of a flying leap and got in the midst of them over this police. They were surrounding them. I got there a little late, as usual. So they were all surrounded, so nobody else could join, and I sort of picked my way through and made a leap, got on top of them. So we all got arrested. And I suddenly decided The shock and awe is about to begin. And as a former Marine, the idea of this U.S. terrorism, mass murder, basically, bombing a city in the way that I knew was about to happen, I decided I wanted to be in jail during that time. That to stay in jail. Here, thanks to Code Pink and Medea Benjamin all got me in there, I found myself in jail. And I thought, I want to stay here for a while the shock and awe is going on. If I go out, I might be tempted to watch that, and I can't bear to watch the bombing of Baghdad. And on the other hand, if what else will I do? I'll escape the TV, I'll go watch a movie or something. And then I'll be thinking that I'm just denying, you know, and escaping. Jail is the place to be. So later, they put me in a van to take me somewhere else. And again, the young cop there who put me in, handcuffed, said, again, why are you doing this? You don't have the money, you know, to pay the fine? I said, no, I have the money. He said, well, why are you doing this? I said, I read a book, actually. He said, what was that? I said, well, you know, Henry David Thoreau, have you heard of him? SALC, he said. No, never heard of him. He's a young American policeman. And I said, well, you ought to read it. It's really very good. And the line was in my head, the proper place today, the only place which Massachusetts, where he was, has provided for her freer and less desponding spirits, is in her prisons, to be put out and locked out of the state by her own act, as they have already put themselves out by their own principles. It is there that the fugitive slave and the Mexican prisoner on parole and the Indian come to plead the wrongs of his race should find them.
Thoreau continues, on that separate but more free and honorable ground where the state places those who are not with her but against her, prison is the only house in a slave state in which a free man can abide with honor. And Daniel Ellsberg took those words to heart. He has been arrested for nonviolent acts of civil disobedience more than 70 times. He became known for his participation in the anti-nuclear war movement in the United States in the late 1970s and early 80s.
The Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Production Facility, the Rocky Flats Truth Force back in 1978. We were sitting on the tracks there. People were on the tracks continuously leading to the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Production Facility that makes all the plutonium triggers for all of our tens of thousands of thermonuclear weapons. And they have to get that train out regularly, in and out, to carry out the waste, lest it poison them. But I remember in particular, we went through the snow. It snowed 36 inches while we were there after we started. It was a hot day like this when we started on the end of April in Colorado, and then it snowed 36 inches, and we rented snowshoes and skis from a skiing outfit who, when they found out where we were going, they gave it all free. We went out over the snow to get near the tracks. We were camped out, very, very cold night, windy night. And the next morning we were just hanging out for a minute, and somebody said, the train is coming down a ravine. Finally, the train was coming through. So we all scrambled through that snow, having made no plan. We'd always assumed that they would arrest us on the tracks before the train came. So there'd been no planning for what to do if the train actually came within sight. So people said, the train is on the way, and came down, and it was kind of a snow-colored valley, snow-covered, and this train is coming along rather slowly through this ravine, and we all scrambled down through the snow and got on the track. And we all assumed, that they didn't want to run us over, but had they practiced stopping? We weren't sure. And how long, you know, would it take him to stop and so forth. So we were sitting there, and one guy who had long red hair, I remember very well, lay down with his head on one rail and his feet on the other. And the train comes at us. We all got behind him. And I was thinking something, and I asked people later, well, what were you going to do if the train didn't stop? And several people said, I wasn't going to get off. And that's the way I was feeling, but I didn't want to say that to anybody because it sounds, you know, too far out or weird. But that's where we were. We'd been fighting this thing for a while, and we were now at a point, okay, if they're gonna send this train at us, it's going to have to be over our bodies. Well, the train did stop, and a huge file of police came out of the train. They were on the train, so they didn't have to walk over the snow.
Daniel Ellsberg is a firm believer in putting his body on the line to stop what he sees as injustice. Here he quotes Ulysses S. Grant, who fought in the Mexican War, reflecting on the morality of war and what a nation has at stake.
This is from, remember, from a lieutenant, later general, who said later, "I am ashamed that I did not resign my commission, but I had not the moral courage to do it at that point." So he goes through the war, like many of his colleagues, believing it was wrong from the start, doing his best as a soldier, and got him promoted, but we were sent to provoke a part. It was very doubtful whether Congress would declare war, but if Mexico should attack our troops, the executive could announce, "Whereas war exists by the acts of, as my president Lyndon Johnson, we have been attacked and I'm responding." And so there had been no attack at all in August of 1964. Now, listen to this. Once initiated, there were but few public men who would have the courage to oppose it. Say that again. Once initiated, there were but few public men who would have the courage to oppose it. Experience proves that the man who obstructs a war in which his nation is engaged, no matter whether right or wrong, occupies no enviable place in life or history. Better for him, individually, to advocate, quote, war, pestilence, and famine, end quote, than to act as an obstructionist to a war already begun. So it took a woman, Barbara Lee, in Oakland, one person in Congress to say no to this. One woman. It took a woman, Cindy Sheehan, to stand up and say, "I am opposing this war already begun. My son's death cannot be honored by the death of others, Iraqis or Americans," to say this must come home, you know, we must stop this. And who knows whether that had something to do with one former hawk, John Murtha, who manages to stand up later and with some spine and confront Democrats with not one joining him. How many of the Democrats who denounced his proposal really disagreed with it? How many really thought we should be there more than 6 months? Notice what Murtha got with his Bronze Star and his two Purple Hearts. Cowards cut and run. Coward, traitor, unpatriotic, treasonable. As Kerry did say, "I will not," they stood up for him personally, he said, "I will not see John Murtha swift-boated." And except, as I say, for Barbara Lee, not one person in 2002 was willing to be called names like that, which is what keeps these people in line. And unless you're willing to face up to those names, you cannot say the truth of your heart and the truth of the situation.
That was Daniel Ellsberg speaking at the Crawford Peace House in Texas. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to freelance producer Sarah Olson and to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Yasuyo Nagata. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Leonard Cohen, Michael Porter and Silver, and Sarah Lovell. For a CD copy of program number 2306, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, and Stefana Petrova and Alina Potts, production interns. And I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.